The following Dharma talk was recorded in March 2013 in St. Louis, Missouri. It is one of five recordings from the retreat called Dana, Sila, and Bhavana, A Gradual Path of Awakening, taught by Bridget Rollins and John Yaffe. The retreat was sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. If you like this recording, you can find more talks at www.midamericadharma.org. For questions, we welcome your emails sent to info@midamericadharma.org. The retreat's teachers, Bridget and John, are co-leaders of the St. Louis Insight Meditation Group. More information about them can be found at www.dharmastl.org.
So welcome back. We're going to continue our discussion of these three pillars by looking at the second pillar of practice, which is sila, or morality in our conduct. I think morality has kind of a, not a bad rap, but it's not fully appreciated because it has so much practicality and so many links to authoritarian aspects in society that the spiritual dimension of it is not readily apparent. It does indeed have tremendous practicality, and as is true in when we were talking about Dana, there's this idea that there's a difference between the practice and the experience or the intentions driving it. So it's certainly possible to conduct ourselves in a very wholesome moral way and yet be motivated by fear of some kind of punishment if we don't conduct ourselves properly because Big Brother is watching or the police or whoever. So it's important, or it's really special in Buddhism to understand that morality flows not from a preoccupation with authoritarian judgments, but from understanding and wisdom. We can see it, the roots of it, in Dana. There's a generosity toward others in embracing the ethic of non-harming and the ethic of preserving the integrity of other people's property and the integrity of their of the respect we have for them sexually, as we heard about in the precepts, but in other dimensions of just honoring their integrity as human beings, etc. I mean, we'll look at the five precepts in detail later in the talk, but just to understand the beauty of a practice where it comes not because we're waiting for some other foot to drop on us, but because it comes from an open heart and an open mind and an understanding of our connectedness to other people. So the roots of it in generosity, the roots of it in right understanding, in understanding the implications of our actions when we consider karma. And also another aspect of karma is the sense of interconnectedness, that that the events, the causes and conditions in this world are caused by an uncountable multitude of factors that stem from our connectedness to all the other beings around us. So that, in a sense, the morality we offer others is just as logical as the morality that says, why would this hand harm that hand? Why would I harm another person if that other person and I are inextricably connected and share the same being? So there really is a deep spirituality to morality when we understand it. In this spirituality and in these teachings, we will come across a boundlessness and an extensiveness that's really the same thing we described in that quote from the Metta Sutta that I read you earlier, that I kind of glommed on and expanded to suggest that it's a quality of of Dana as well. In fact, I think the one of the dimensions of spirituality is the extensiveness and the boundlessness of the mind states that arise in spiritual connectedness. So there's boundlessness, there's extensiveness, there's also subtlety. And you'll see this in the teachings as well, that we're, when we talk about non-harming, we're not saying avoid harming under this circumstance, but it's really okay over here, which we do find in a lot of other sets of moral guidelines. So there's this sense of it just keeps rolling out. And at first, it's depending upon your maturity and your practice, it could be, oh, you mean I can't kill these guys either? You mean not only can I not kill people, but I can't kill bad guys and I can't kill bugs? I shouldn't kill bugs. And I shouldn't crush people's spirit? What's that about? So there's this, we can't, when it first dawns upon us, that extensiveness has implications in the way we're supposed to treat other people and even treat ourselves. There can be, oh boy, I've got a lot to do here. You know, it's sort of like that bumper sticker that says, Jesus is coming, look busy. Just one of my favorite bumper stickers. So there is that quality of, boy, there's a lot to do here, but when we put the doing behind us, or better still, incorporate it into our being and connect to the feelings of it, the feelings of it are exquisite because they're just outward and unbounded, the way it says in the Metta Sutta, and they are very rich and very delightful. So there's boundlessness, there's extensiveness, there's this subtlety that I described, that it keeps rolling out in subtler and finer ways, and we'll see this as we describe the specifics. And there's a freedom from grasping and attachment in our awareness, which is at the heart of our morality. So these are some opening thoughts about it to help us connect not just with the practicality of it, which certainly is there, but with the spirituality. So we have the five precepts as sort of the gross categories. If you were monastics, I think there would be like 262 or something like that. There's a lot of guidelines. And I'm sure I haven't studied those. I'm sure they do get very specific and nitpicky, and wherever you get that way, the spiritual core is a little harder to see. So in a sense, we're lucky that we have five. So, real briefly, the overview of the five precepts, we subscribed to them last night, assuming you were willing to. The idea, the first precept being abstaining from the taking of life. The second being abstaining from taking what is not given. The third is abstaining from sexual misconduct. The fourth is abstaining from false speech. And the fifth is abstaining from misusing intoxicants. So all of these have this kind of thou shalt not quality, the abstaining. And there are, and I will share with you, formulations which come at these from the positive side. And they are quite delightful. So it's worth pausing for just a moment or two to ask ourselves, why did the Buddha in the core presentation, sort of the bare bones presentation of these attributes, approach it from the abstaining side? And it's very profound and subtle, and that is that when we are shown the positive, it's pleasant, we like it, we tend to grasp after it and cling to it. So in all of the Buddha's teachings, there is this tendency to talk about the avoidance of the negative as opposed to the going after the positive. And really, the whole flavor of the Buddha's presentation is that the mind is basically this radiant entity which is simply obscured by all these defilements, and our job is not to grasp after the radiance, but to drop the defilements that prevent that radiance from showing forth. So we see that here too, that when we speak of abstaining, it sounds negative, but it's really a gift in the same spirit as the gift of noble silence, in that it's a gift that is designed to minimize the tendency we have to go after things and crave and cling and grasp. But that being said, I'm going to give you sort of a back and forth between the two. What I want to do here is describe the precepts in terms of the core teaching and sort of the rollout to show you the extensiveness and the subtlety. And then I want to refer to a a write-up of them that was adapted by Thich Nhat Hanh. There's actually several different, slightly different formulations, because he's been tweaking these probably over decades. The one I have is called Working with the Five Mindfulness Trainings. They're... And actually, I think this one comes from... this is one of the later ones. There's an earlier one. There's a book he wrote called For a Future to Be Possible, which presents an early version of these formulations, and then there's a collection of essays on all these different positive aspects of the precepts. Very, very lovely book. Anyway, so I'll be going back and forth between elaborating on what we're abstaining from and then talking about the very positive side of that, which is there as well. So if we start with abstaining from taking life, we can roll out from the gross to the subtle. So we begin with abstaining from illegal killing, murder, terrorism, ethnic cleansing, genocide, all those things that we ask you to to hold off on. And for most of us, we're already not doing that. And yet there's plenty of it going on around us. But then it moves on to subtler forms. So there are legal killings that are perfectly sanctioned in this society. There's capital punishment. And we may not participate in that directly, but we are witnesses to it, and by our silence in respect to it, we are offering tacit agreement. So there's that. There's sanctioned warfare. And, you know, these are very complicated issues when we look at them. You can make a very logical case for a certain degree of defense capability being preventive. But you can also see sometimes when going to war is not the most wholesome thing to do. There's the issue of abortion, which in this society is a legal form of ending a life. So we may have legitimate positions on that, certainly understandable, justifiable positions, but there is at the heart of it the taking of a life, and it's hard to not acknowledge that. There is non-human killing, the killing of mammals, birds, reptiles, amphibians, and insects. Why do we do that? We do that to eat. We do it to eliminate disease vectors. We do it for deliberate or unthinking matters of convenience. We don't like bugs in our house, so we stomp them. Some of us don't like bugs in our house, and we capture them and release them. And then there's the issue of discriminating. Well, a spider I'll catch and release. How do I feel about a cockroach? And in fact, a few years ago, I made a point of catching and releasing a cockroach in my kitchen. And, you know, there was a little, you know, there was that sense of wholesomeness, and then there was, well, I'm kind of internally bragging about it in some perverse way, too. So there's that whole stuff that I mentioned earlier in the context of generosity of, you know, there can be one mind state present one minute and a completely different one, more positive or less positive, can be present the next. Try to be aware of all that. the subtlety continues. We can be killing in the way we handle dissent and disagreement with us. How dare you say that to me? My mother used to say, you know, whenever I stood up to my mother, she'd say, "You're out of order." Which, now, it's one of, you know, I think we were talking yesterday about how, maybe not, I don't know, how children hear things. Now, what she, you know, when I hear "out of order" now, I think of, well, there's this parliamentary procedure. You're not procedurally in order, you know, like I needed to submit a request in triplicate to stand up to her that I didn't do or something like that. But as a child, what I understood out of order meant was it was a sign on a Coke machine that meant it didn't work. So I thought she was saying, "You're broken. You're defective. Something wrong with you. Not that you're standing up to me, but that there's something wrong." And, you know, maybe she intended that, maybe she didn't. We'll worry about that later. But in the way parents talk to children, there is assumptions regarding the use of language, and right speech is a whole separate category of the precepts. We'll get to that in a minute. But there's assumptions about what we're communicating, and we need to be very careful with those assumptions. You know, the same way I suggested that you set aside your predetermined views of what you're going to experience and, you know, what's happening and what's right and what's wrong, we need to set aside our pre-existing understandings of how we're getting across to people and really check with them to see what they're hearing. So there's the killing of dissent. There's killing as a metaphor in sports and business. You know, we creamed them, we obliterated them. Rah! You know, hooray. Kicking their butts. Killing the spirit. I think of the Boy Scouts' exclusionary policies regarding gays and atheists. I was a Boy Scout leader for something like 26, 27 years, and you just sort of shrug it off. At the unit level, scouting can be a magnificent a thing that really benefits boys. But as an institution, it's got some real issues. In terms of saying that certain things are unacceptable, are out of order in the way my mother said it and meant it, or the way I heard my mother saying it. So in scouting, not only, you know, you hear there's publicity right now about their evolving position on gays. It's really not as evolving as they describe it. But there is no talk about their thing about their attitude toward atheists, and they'll kick scouts out of troops and deny them merit badges or moving on to Eagle Scout because of avowed atheism, which I have a lot of trouble with. I mean, you know, assuming religiosity or religion has great value, how will you ever win people over to it if you just say, "Get out of here, there's something wrong with you"? Crazy. Killing the spirit. So there's all of these things that have an aspect of killing to them, some gross and obvious, some subtle, and some extensive. So if we look to the positive side of that same set of issues, we have Thich Nhat Hanh saying, and I love these because the very first phrase of all of them has to do with because our mind was open to these truths. So he begins by saying, aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life. We could just pause there and reflect on that. Aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating compassion, both for myself and for others. I am committed to learning ways to protect the lives of beings in the world. I am determined not to kill or to support any act of killing in the world, in my thinking and in my way of life. So this is the positive assertion of these same values. It's very sweet. The second precept, abstaining from taking what is not given. So here again, we can build a list. We can talk about abstaining from stealing, taking for things secretly behind people's back. We can abstain from robbery, using force or threats. when people are present, snatching, grabbing someone's possessions before they can resist, fraud and deceit, which begins moving in the direction of subtlety, when we use false weights and measures to cheat customers, or trick them through some scam, you know, sell them something that isn't as described. In terms of the expansiveness into subtlety, we can talk about stealing time, stealing glory or credit from co-workers in the workplace, stealing respect, which is a way of, you know, denying respect, denying attention, not being fully present has a dimension of taking things away from people. Once you understand what it is to be truly present in communication, when you duck out of that presence, there is this sense of, well, I'm taking something from the situation, or I'm taking something from the people. The idea of, and sometimes it extends backward into the whole issue of life, to be texting while driving. You know, on the one hand, it's just denying, it's stealing attention from the road. But the implication of that is that you create danger that can result in loss of life. So when the Buddha talked about these things, he talked about the moral weight of the actions being determined by three factors in the context of thief. There's the value of the object taken, which we can reflect upon. The qualities of the victim of the theft, which we're less likely to think about, because we tend to get absolute in our thinking. If I'm taking something, it's wrong, period. But if you were, you know, thinking about taking a dollar, for example, to take it from someone who has nothing versus taking it from the table of a millionaire, might have a different karmic weight to it. I'm not saying how we should feel about this. I'm just saying these are things, if you're looking to investigate, these are things to investigate. And the subjective state of the thief is a factor as well, because you can be stealing because you feel there's been an injustice and you're setting it right. Again, I'm not, you know, that has a quality of rationale, so I'm not necessarily standing up for that, but I'm saying all of these can be weighed in the balance. Regarding the third dimension, acts of theft can be motivated by greed or hatred, or they can be perhaps mitigated by distortion, motivated by love or affection, a Robin Hood kind of theft. So again, this is an invitation for us to reflect on these things and to become expansive in our understanding of it and subtle, and to avoid being judgmental, but simply navigate a path through it. The third precept, abstaining from sexual misconduct. Oh, the positive. Thank you. It takes a village. I do thank you. So here we have... I get so into my stuff. Okay. Aware of the suffering caused by exploitation, social injustice, stealing, and oppression. I am committed to cultivating loving kindness and learning ways to work for the well-being of all beings. I will practice generosity by sharing my time, space, and material resources with those who are in real need. I am determined not to steal and not to possess anything that should belong to others. I will respect the property of others. And then this last phrase is something we need to investigate. This is Thich Nhat Hanh's flavor. I will prevent others from profiting from human suffering or the suffering of other species on the earth. So this is his going further, and we have our own decisions to make about how we view this and how we choose to do it. But, you know, saying I will, in his framework, become somewhat activist. in terms of standing up to oppression and exploitation. And how far you go with that is a challenge. And how you, if you do become activist, the spiritual dimension of the challenge in that is how do you act with activism and at the same time act with loving kindness? How do you stand up to someone while not hating them, while wishing them well and wishing them illumination and enlightenment and all the best for them in the world, and seeing that their actions will become more wholesome the more illuminated they become, as opposed to the more you get your way. It's challenging. It's very challenging. But it's also kind of delicious to contemplate. Abstaining from sexual misconduct. This and a few of the others, I always, whenever I come across these, I just back up for a minute and just appreciate the Buddha. You know, we're still working on I forget the name of the act, but there's this domestic abuse act that's just now coming up for renewal in Congress. I think it finally got through, but it's like it's very timely. And here he was talking about protecting the sexual integrity and really more extensively just the humanity, you know, treating all humans with integrity and respect. 2,600 years ago, I love it. I part of the reason I embrace this practice is the lineage of it, just the fact that it's been seeing clearly for 2,600 years. It's just very charming. So, what are the dimensions of sexual misconduct? Forcing yourself upon another, manipulating, if you love me, you do this, not just the physical abuse of people, but the emotional manipulation of them. And the flip side of it, I guess, I don't have this whole list of it because to me it doesn't need that. But the positive side of it is worth looking at. Aware of the suffering caused by sexual misconduct, I am committed to cultivating responsibility and learning ways to protect the safety and integrity of individuals, couples, families, and society. Feel that extensive rollout? Where does that end? I am determined not to engage in sexual relations without love and a long-term commitment. We get to sort our way through that. We may... Who knows how we feel about that, but it's something certainly to investigate. To preserve the happiness of others and of myself and others, I am determined to respect my commitments and the commitments of others. I will do everything in my power to protect children from sexual abuse and to keep couples and families from being broken by sexual misconduct. The fourth area, abstaining from false speech or embracing right speech. This is like two or three talks by itself. It's this huge topic, and it's something all of us can benefit from really making integral to our practice and really cooking on that one. That one takes a long time on the stove to cook down. It's huge, and it's wonderful. The first element of it is simply to avoid saying things that are untrue. And I've got a whole segue on that. Right speech. The Buddha divides right speech into four components: abstaining from false speech. So he has this quote, "Herein, someone avoids false speech and abstains from it. He speaks the truth, is devoted to truth." Notice he's not saying the truth. He's saying devoted to truth as a principle. reliable, worthy of confidence, not a deceiver of people. Being at a meeting or amongst people or in the midst of his relatives or in a society or in the king's court and called upon and asked as witness to tell what he knows, he answers, "If he knows nothing, I know nothing." And if he knows, he answers, "I know." Not hard. Really simple. If he has seen nothing, he answers, "I have seen nothing." And if he has seen, he answers, "I have seen." Thus, he never knowingly speaks a lie, either for the sake of his own advantage, or for the sake of another person's advantage, or for the sake of any advantage whatsoever. Just keeps rolling out. I want to segue. I went to the doctor. I went to a consulting neurosurgeon this week. I've been having this strange problem that comes from my lower back or hips. I've been having episodes of having pain and a little bit of weakness and falling down. So I went to the doctor. I had an MRI, and the MRI comes back with this heavy sounding thing, which I've made into a chant. What was it? Hold on. Severe bilateral foraminal stenosis. Severe bilateral foraminal stenosis. I take medication, but I don't know what the dose is. So I'm working on this whole sort of rap song thing. Anyway, I'm nervous. I'm thinking, and Papancha gets going, And my doctor said he didn't want to read the MRI. He's referring me to a neurosurgeon. Doesn't sound good. So I go to this guy, and this guy looks the thing, and he's tisk-tisking about the quality of the MRI. But we go through it, and he says, "Okay, you've got typical age-related..." I think it's, disc deterioration disease or something like that. You're shot. You're 67. You got stuff. He says, "There's nothing there that explains this. I don't know what's going on." I said, "Thank you." I was so, he said, "When I was younger, it would have been really hard to say, 'I don't know.'" He said, "Now it's just, what is. I don't know, and we'll send you to someone else who hopefully will be able to figure it out." But because I came in there with this whole doomsday scenario, there's a nuclear device implanted in your spine, and you need surgery, and because he didn't know, what he did know is that there was nothing in the MRI that explained what was going on, and thus surgery was not required. So to be honest about not knowing was this tremendous gift. So, truthfulness. There's a dana aspect to it. The Buddha continued. He says, "When one is not ashamed to tell a deliberate lie, there is no evil that one would not do." It's a real indicator. Think of your politicians. Okay. He avoids slanderous speech. He avoids slanderous speech and abstains from it. What he has heard here, he does not repeat there, so as to cause dissension there. And what he has heard there, he does not repeat here, so as to cause dissension here. Thus, he unites those who are divided, and those who are united, he encourages. So there's a sense of avoiding slander as a way of creating a sense of unity and peacefulness, concord. Concord gladdens him. He delights and rejoices in concord, and it is concord that he spreads by his words. That's the second dimension, avoiding slander. It also has an implication of avoiding gossip, because gossip typically is second and third hand. Hence, it's not true. You don't have direct knowledge of it. The third dimension is abstaining from harsh speech. He avoids harsh language and abstains from it. He speaks such words as are gentle, soothing to the ear, loving, such words as go to the heart, as are courteous, friendly, and agreeable to many. And the last dimension of right speech, I mean, we can find more, but the last classical dimension of it, is abstaining from idle chatter. Well, that's going to save us a lot of time. He avoids idle chatter and abstains from it. He speaks at the right time, in accordance with facts, speaks what is useful, speaks of the Dhamma and the discipline. His speech is like a treasure, uttered at the right moment, accompanied by reason, moderate, and full of sense. So just an elaboration on this is that exposure to the idle chatter constantly bombarding us through the news media and other media, television, radio, newspapers, pulp journals, and cinema, turns into a continuous stream of needless information and distracting entertainment, the net effect of which is to leave the mind passive, vacant, and sterile. That obviously was not something the Buddha said, but it's something I picked up. So, let me go back to my core thing here. So as you can see, there really is a lot to say about right speech. So the Buddha went on in another dimension to say there's four categories of communication and our responsibility regarding each category. So he says that we can be saying something that is untrue and displeasing to hear. So basically saying things can be true or false, pleasing and non-pleasing. So something can be untrue and displeasing to hear, such as a false accusation, and the guideline with respect to doing that is don't. Okay. The next is voicing something that is untrue but is pleasing to hear, such as flattery. The Buddha's advice regarding that is no. Because he comes down firm on the issue of untruth. He continues, saying something that is true but displeasing to hear, such as perhaps constructive criticism. So there, he doesn't just say yes, because it's true. He says that kind of thing should only be spoken when the person is receptive to what is being said, when the timing is right. When they, or perhaps it occurred to me, when they are about to act in a harmful manner, so there's a real urgency to intervening. But in general, the issue is the timing has to be right, which has to do with the receptivity of the person or some kind of perhaps external urgency. And the last of the four is that something is true and pleasing to hear, such as positive feedback. So you might be tempted to say, green light, let's go ahead. The Buddha says that kind of speech also should be withheld until the timing is suitable. So for example, if you praise people in the presence of others who might be competing with them, you're fomenting, I'm not sure which it is, envy. You know? You have to be aware of the collateral damage of what's going on. How am I doing for time? I have a story I want to tell. What? Okay, so this story, this is a joke, but I like telling jokes that fit my purpose. So there's a story about a psychologist who's a behaviorist. And he's trying to make his presence felt on a psychiatric ward, and there's this guy there who is incontinent, and who no one has been able to work with. So he says, "I can behaviorism, perfect. I can do this." So he goes to this fellow and says, "Here, I have a plate of cookies. If you can simply get out of bed and put your legs over the side before wetting yourself, I will give you a cookie." So he does that for a week. Then he approaches the guy with this, the remaining cookies on the plate, and says, "If you can walk to the door of your room before wetting yourself, I will give you a cookie." And the guy does that. He says, "Now, if you can get halfway down the wall between your or the corridor, the aisle, between your room and the men's room before wetting yourself, I will give you a cookie." It works. He says, "Okay, if you get all the way to the urinal and urinate in the urinal, you get your cookie." It worked. The only downside was that all the other patients on the floor started wetting themselves. There's a time and a place for all communications. So, okay. So, we've mentioned that also to be avoided are gossip and words that divide others and glorify the self or others we favor, as well as speech that is silly or frivolous. That's the other standard thing. The thing that's not there, but which has been added by people like Thich Nhat Hanh, is the importance of mindful listening. And mindful listening is bringing the same qualities that we bring to our meditation practice and work with internally, cultivate internally with respect to the workings within our mind. We apply those same principles to being present with whatever another person is saying, so that when the other person is speaking, our attention stays present. We don't segue into mental commentary. We don't segue into judgment. We don't segue into how to fix them. And we don't get reminded of something that's real similar to what that person is saying that happened to us 32 years ago that they've just brought back. We stay present. And just as in your meditation practice, you come to understand that, you know, when you're with the breath and with the breath and you're suddenly thinking about lunch, you're no longer with the breath. You've just plain left. And you have to wake up and you have to come back. The same thing is true when we're in dialogue with another person. When we get into mental commentary, when we get into judgment, when we drift off into our own thoughts, we've left the conversation. It's as if we said, "Wait a minute," and left the room. Only we're still there, so we're not being honest about it. So, obviously, that's the negative formulation, but the positive formulation is the true gift of our presence that doesn't necessarily require commentary or fixing. People simply want to be heard, simply want to be heard. This, the positive side, aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others. Again, you could just repeat that. Yeah, if nothing else happens, if you were aware of that, good things would happen. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful speech and the inability to listen to others. I am committed to cultivating loving speech and deep listening in order to bring joy and happiness to others and relieve others of their suffering. Knowing that words can create happiness or suffering, I am determined to speak truthfully with words that inspire confidence, joy, and understanding. I will not spread news that I do not know to be certain, and I will refrain from criticism and condemnation unless I am positive it is just and warranted. I will refrain from uttering words that can cause division or discord, or that can cause the family or the community to break. I am determined to make all efforts to reconcile and resolve all conflicts, however small. And the last of the precepts, which is another one of these that I have to stand back and just admire the Buddha for being there, just being on the spot so long ago and having put this clarity in motion that's lasted so long. Abstaining from misusing intoxicants. avoiding intoxicants which confuse the mind and cause heedless behavior, and ingest only those substances that are nourishing and supportive of peaceful abiding. Alcohol and drugs weaken our mental faculties, directly feed gross cycles of dependent origination, and often lead to unskillful actions. On a more subtle level, we need to avoid exposing our minds to less obvious intoxicants, such as movies, books, and television programs filled with images of sexuality, violence, and the search for sensual gratification. These just inflame the mind. Allowing these images to run unimpeded through our minds affects our thinking process and can lead to unwholesome behaviors. So Thich Nhat Hanh's positive side of this is aware of the suffering caused by unmindful consumption. Interesting turn of phrase, unmindful consumption. So that would include not just intoxicants, but you know, food can be something we use to wash over our awareness. We can sedate ourselves through foods or seduce ourselves away from dealing with real issues because we're pursuing comfort and comforts. Aware of the suffering caused by unmindful consumption, I'm committed to cultivating good health, both physical and mental, for myself, my family, and my society, by practicing mindful eating, drinking, and consuming. So, wow, he's not just talking about, you know, taking stuff into the body. He's also talking about the stuff we buy, the stuff we adorn ourselves with. I will ingest only items that preserve peace, well-being, and joy in my body, my consciousness, and in the collective body and consciousness of my family and society. That's challenging. I'm determined not to overuse alcohol or any other intoxicants, or to ingest foods or other items that are toxic to body, heart, and mind. I will work to transform violence, fear, anger, and confusion in myself and in society. So, is this about when we were supposed to be done? Okay, so I have for you on the table over there the handout of the Thich Nhat Hanh formulation. There's also at the very bottom, I managed to squeeze on some teachings, a very terse teaching of a follow-up teaching called Clear Comprehension. So when we become mindful of things, the mindfulness tends to have a very here and now flavor to it. Clear comprehension brings in the topic of context, which helps us helps us broaden our awareness. I saw someone going, "Oh no, more stuff." Anyway, there's clear comprehension of purpose, suitability, domain, and clear comprehension without delusion. I'll let you research those on your own. It's another topic, but a worthy one and very complimentary. So those are a number of thoughts on Sila. So thank you.